It's Saturday, July 19, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or of any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the studio with me is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And also we have special guest Daniel Shaw. He's never been on Geek Speak before, but welcome, Daniel. Daniel is a Node.js developer and host of the NodeUp podcast. Hi, Dan.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. All right, so you come to Santa Cruz much, Dan?
Not very often. It's probably been a year and a half, 2 years since we've been down.
And so but, if you're a big part of the Node community, you have to be in Oakland, right? That's kind of where you must
no,
be.
No, no, necessarily. No, no, no. The developers in Oakland like to think that. It's awesome. Oakland's beautiful. Great community there. But, you know, not the only one. I happen to be one of the weird individuals that chose to move with family into San Francisco. It's one of those things that, you know, everyone says, no, you should not, like... It's the least sane thing to do, but we love it. We love living in downtown San Francisco. It's awesome.
Well, welcome to Geek Speak. So, and we'll talk more about what you do and your business and all that in a little bit. But first, let's cover some geek news. Miles, you're up first.
Oh, Verizon. This is an area where, you know, Lyle works for Netflix, so he can't really talk about it. But I don't work for Netflix, which means talk about it. Which is that Verizon, if you've been following the show, has been saying that, oh, well, we need to charge Netflix because they are going through an intermediary called Level 3 that isn't providing, isn't paying us enough for the amount of bandwidth that's being exchanged between, that's Verizon's story.
Okay, so Level 3 is one of those large data aggregation systems which has large networks.
Right,
and people,
also known as a backbone provider.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Okay.
And never mind the fact that Verizon's customers are paying Verizon to say, we want access to the internet. Netflix is on the internet. Therefore, it seems like that's a pretty straightforward equation. We're paying you to get access to stuff that's on the internet. Netflix is on the internet. Pay what you need to do for the infrastructure to get to Netflix.
Interesting.
But, you know, my view and the view of many others out there.
Well, so let me ask you something about that, though, Miles. If you had an ISP and they weren't even connected to the internet, and they just give you really fast connections to them, would that not be what you're paying for? Is that what you're saying?
That would fall, in my opinion, under the same guise as, yes, you have this great restaurant, and you can go, and you have to pay ahead of time for the food, but there really isn't all that much food there.
You can't get his breadsticks as fast as you want them.
Okay. No, like an all-you-can-eat buffet, but they give you one plate and you can't refill the plate.
All right, okay, I got it.
And they charge more if you want to have a milkshake, you know, the thing, even though it's an all-you-can-eat. And so people have been looking at the response from Netflix saying, no, 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 see, this is our infrastructure, and this is why we need to charge more for Netflix, and this is what's going on with that. Their own diagram was something that people have been using saying, yeah, Netflix is really not on the up and up. Level 3, the backbone provider, has actually come out and said, okay, really the only thing that's at issue with us is the number of 10 gigabit connections between us.
Between which?
Between Netflix and Level 3.
Okay. So they aren't peering well enough?
Right.
Okay.
The congestion is happening because Verizon is making the congestion happen at that point. It's a throttling. Which
throttling.
Verizon
okay.
was saying, no, we're not doing that at all, except that a user who made a blog post called Verizon Made an Enemy Tonight, he had access to a VPN connection that would take him to another route.
So a VPN is a virtual private network, and you basically say, I want all my data encrypted from here to this other location on the internet, and that other location I will then emerge as a point.
Right, and that other point did not have a connection to Verizon.
Okay.
That connection was through some other carrier.
So the person at home has connection to Verizon. uses that connection on the internet to, through Verizon through the internet to use a private encrypted channel that goes all the way to some other place.
Right.
Okay. Got it. That should make everything slower because now
right,
you've
because you're adding an extra hop and you're adding in an encryption layer. So there is no reason why that should ever be faster.
Right.
Now, when he didn't have the VPN as a point of reference, he was getting something on the order of 375 kilobits per second.
That's pitifully slow for video streaming.
A third of a megabit.
Right.
So, in other words, he was going to be buffering a lot. The video quality was going to be the lowest possible.
Netflix is actually going to deliver a lower quality video stream based on the traffic flow that occurs. Right. That's what
but even at that level, you're going to end up with skips and buffering.
Yes,
and
it's not going to be good.
It's not going to be smooth. So he turned on the VPN. And by the way, also as a point of reference, he has a Verizon Fios.
Oh, man. That's
account.
A fast network.
Right. So he was supposed to, he was paying for a, I believe, 75 megabit per second connection. So he connected up the VPN, and he started getting, we don't know exactly how fast he could have gotten. He simply maxed out what Netflix would give, which is a 3 megabit stream.
Right.
In other words, that's the
higher
HD
quality
stream.
On it. Yeah, yeah, sure.
So he was getting 10 times the speed connecting up. And the only reason it didn't go higher was because Netflix doesn't provide video at a higher bit rate than that.
Okay, so first off, I hate that you're covering Netflix stories because I have to mute myself because I work for the company. And but I can tell you factually, we do provide, Netflix does provide faster networks. We have some of them that are on a 4K video feed. Some titles are. So that title probably wasn't on that feed, but it is possible to be more. But in case.
What's the bitstream?
I don't know. I'm not in that group. I make web apps.
Right, because I mean, Blu-ray is not 4K,
right.
But it's much larger than your typical high definition 1080p connection that goes down because the encryption is wrenched.
Right. I'm just saying that HD, the full HD stream that you can get on some titles, you can actually get on other titles. You can get a higher higher feed than that.
So possibly could have been like 6 megabit.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Could be more. Anyway, but what the point is that. He's being told
either of the pitiful levels that the U.S. broadband market is allowing. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that this home user who tested this through Verizon saying you've got Fios, you've got this really fast connection, and the reason why you can't do Netflix quickly is because it's the Netflix isn't servicing fast enough. Verizon has a story.
They're going through level 3, and level 3 isn't paying enough money, but they're not really throttling. It's a problem with the internet connection that they're not getting compensated enough.
That's the story Verizon's telling.
Yes.
Okay. But then when he tries to connect but through a different route, not through the Verizon network, then he gets good, fast access to Netflix.
Yes.
Even though he's starting from the Verizon network, just in a different way.
Right.
But doesn't that say that either side could have a problem still, just that the connection between the three of them?
Well, one, it means that technically Verizon could take a different route to Netflix. But in addition to that, the interconnections that we're talking about here, there are already links between Level 3 and Verizon.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, there wouldn't be any connection at all. And so you have, for example, these 10 gigabit per second connections between the two providers. The amount of money required to up
the count, uh-huh.
Yeah. Is not on the level of, you know, thousands of dollars a customer. It's on the level of thousands of dollars. And I mean, when I say thousands, I mean less than 10.
Okay.
Or maybe 10. Something on the grand scale of ISPs.
Let's say
if
$10,000 were invested in this problem, it would just go away.
Yes.
Why are they not doing it? What's going on?
Level 3 actually upped the ante and said, if that's your problem, we'll pay for the interconnects. We'll front the money for the extra few thousand dollars to get that peering level up to snuff.
Okay, so why isn't Verizon doing it then?
Because Verizon wants to get paid on both ends, is my personal opinion.
And the opinions here are of our own, ourselves. Yes. All right.
Well, didn't Comcast pay up? Didn't Comcast pay up? So, you know, isn't it Verizon's time to get their dime?
That's the thing, though. Aside from the fact that neither company is particularly well regarded with regard to customer service, and the fairness with.
Are you speaking of Verizon?
Netflix and Verizon, right?
Yeah.
Netflix and Comcast.
No, in dragging fairness, you in, dragging you in.
I feel myself losing my job and my radio show all at once.
Sorry. No. In fairness, Comcast is not the worst rated customer service company anymore. They're actually number six in the nation.
Who's number one?
All right. Number one is Time Warner, who Comcast just bought.
Nice. All right. Leveling up.
So they are.
Recapturing number one spot.
So they'll average out to three. That's right, great for them.
Right. So the reason why I am skeptical of their story is because there are so many other providers out there that don't have a problem serving Netflix.
No. Interesting.
Suddenly it's just Comcast and Verizon. And I say this as a Netflix customer. Like And Comcast, got their money, and the speed improved immediately because they were already doing it.
I saw the graph. It was like, this is getting worse, and you paid. And like, whoa,
right?
It actually works.
Well, actually, did you also notice that everything was fine, and then came the news stories where they were saying, like, no, we should get paid, and so net neutrality became a really big deal, and you started seeing that graph plummet down.
So you think it was intentional?
And then it went up again.
Got it.
Around the time that they were like, oh, yeah, let's, you know, there was some connections being made ahead of time leading up to the deal being announced and then the speeds going up. Verizon, for its part, actually has made a deal with Netflix already. But because they hadn't started doing the infrastructure changes beforehand, they still haven't ramped up. They're still slow. So in other words,
They paid, but the check hasn't cashed.
Right. If I'm going to just editorialize here, Verizon customers.
What have you been doing the entire
time? Yes.
Someone needs to do it.
Verizon customers have paid for access to the internet. They paid for access to Verizon separately, and now they're going to be paying that extra money to Verizon because now Netflix, or rather, extra money to Netflix because Netflix now has to pay for that. Has to send those costs somewhere. And yet the connection still isn't very good yet.
It's depressing, isn't it?
You'll forgive me if I say that I'm not really inclined to take Verizon's word on much of this.
Cool.
It's going to be a slow drift into providing the utility that we need out of the infrastructure companies. And, whether it's cellular or cable or connectivity in any way, we essentially want dumb, fast pipe.
Yes.
And,
it doesn't feel like they get that, right?
No.
Feel like the
fundamentally,
ISPs are like,
they don't get
we're going to be a media company now, too. It's like, no, don't do that. Just connect us to the network and get out of our way.
Right.
And we'll put up with your horrible customer service if we can.
Yeah, let me pay you a little bit more money for,
if it costs
more reliable, faster, dumber pipe.
Right. If it can't be done, then why are companies like SonicNet and, for that matter, AT&T,
and Google.
Yeah, and Google Fiber, and AT&T and with their DSL service.
The country of South Korea.
That's right, countries do this.
Most of the Nordic countries.
Yeah, but I also mean things like DSL, like AT&T DSL. Yes, it only goes up to 6 megabits. Mm. But people are actually getting that for the Netflix connection.
All right, let's move on to a story that I can participate without feeling like I'm in danger. So, Dan, you got some gaming news or something?
All right, so I'm going to throw down with the gaming story and try to make this interesting. So Mendel Noriega is suing Activision over his image, his character likeness being used in Call of Duty 2.
So Mendel Noriega, the former...
Sorry, I happen to be one of the old people. So, I actually grew up when
Noriega
was a thing.
Yeah.
He's the former dictator of Panama and...
ousted during the first Bush administration.
First Bush? Okay, yeah. I was going to put him at Reagan. An infamous guy.
Yeah, yeah. It's fun for game companies to make him a villain.
Right.
It's basically
what's
happened in Call of Duty, right?
A reasonable choice of a villain, but at the same time is a living person, and they're essentially stealing his likeness.
Is he suing in the U.S.?
The jurisdiction of the case is in the U.S.
Cool.
The suit is against Activision.
See, what Activision should do right now is settle for a lot of money and request him to do video work in their next game.
That
right?
would be amazing.
Because then he could be a character.
The right? representation in the game is him in his younger years back in 91 or
being
so.
Being really evil.
And
being evil, probably. Right. Well, his objection.
No, actually being more to the point, though many of us like to forget this, 91 was 23 years ago?
Yeah. There's a reason why we like to forget this.
Right. So Manuel Noriega is now 80 years old. I don't know if they want to do okay. video work for him now. They want the likeness of him when he was recognizable on TV
sure, of course.
24 years ago.
Got it.
Well, so,
or 23 years ago.
So if it was, you know, if it was a textbook talking about him as a political figure, mm-hmm. of course, and textbook companies make money, that wouldn't be mm-hmm. something you could sue on, right? Because it's factual information. But when you're doing it in an entertainment venue, it does make sense that, you know, if anybody's likeness is used, you theoretically can protect your own likeness.
Right.
So it should be...
Well, he can make
a lot of money off it, too. It's a successful game.
Part of his problem is also that he was depicted in a negative light. So the...
you think?
Right. he was doing, you know, conspiratorial activities. He helped the CIA in the game and then, you know, subsequently turned on the CIA and became this sort of arch villain. So,
in other words, it's not a game, it's a history treatise.
Right. Like, so he claims it misrepresented.
Fundamentally
so
a good
is
guy.
It going to be then... Right. In this court case, we're going to find out if it is misrepresenting it. Like, that's what the solution is. Was he exactly this guy?
He was defamed.
Well, I mean, with Noriega, also, he's not a U.S. citizen. He doesn't have residence
right.
here. So
no, he's in jail.
It has that question
Panama.
Whether or not he has standing.
He's in jail in Panama.
But at the same time, it does bring in a question of, do public figures have the right to their likeness or their activities? For example, Lindsay Lohan sued because... I believe Rockstar Games.
Started using her.
Mm-hmm. Well, didn't use her specifically. Didn't use her by name. Used a different name.
They were careful.
Lohine. Someone,
it was much more different than that. But okay. at the same time, the likeness was of a pretty white girl and who was a starlet who got
it
into...
It was based off that character, her. Is her
it
argument.
Was, but right. it was based off of the antics of Hollywood actors who have... You know, substance abuse problems and right. impulse control problems.
And
so that has.
So they base the character randomly off of someone kind of despicable, and she's like, "Hey, stop copying me."
I represent that.
It's quite possible the news stories had to do with that, but at the same time,
Yeah. All right, let's take a break on Geekspeak. We'll be back in just a minute here on KOSP. When he was 14. Percy DeConis ran away from home to become one of the world's great magicians. Now, he's a world-class mathematician, and his two professions have a lot in common. Mathematician Percy DeConis. Tomorrow on KOSP's 7th Avenue Project at noon with Robert Pauly. Do listen in. It's one of those great shows we have here on KOSP. All right, so we've been talking about some geek news. We're going to get into a discussion about what Dan actually does for a profession. But, Miles, can you give us a geek bit first, something that you got to see to believe?
There's a hole in the ground.
Moving on.
great story.
It better be a big hole. a big mysterious hole by chance?
Well, it's a crater in the ground 60 meters wide in Siberia, northern Siberia.
Okay. So that's 60 yards for us Americans.
A little more than that, but yeah.
Okay.
Wait, yards? What is this yard?
It's almost a football field wide, everybody. It's America.
And it just showed up. People are like, there's a hole in the ground. Why is there a hole in the ground?
Wait, when I think crater, I think of like asteroid falling, hitting.
Right.
Did it show up after a giant impact?
That's what people were looking at going, but we would have noticed if a meteor had made a strike. As, right. for example, in Russia earlier in the year, mm-hmm. there in February 2013, rather, not only saw it, but you heard it.
Yeah, like
it
was. Okay, is that the one that broke up? And there's tons of video of it of people driving around.
Yeah,
broke a whole bunch of in the front of the cameras.
Yeah, broke a whole bunch of windows in surrounding cities. That type of thing.
So this one just is all of a sudden there's a hole.
There's a hole. And I'm like, what's going on?
How deep is the hole?
Deep enough that you can fly a helicopter into it.
That's a big hole.
And the crater is about 30 kilometers away from the largest gas field. And no, I'm not going to convert that to miles. and so they were looking, going like, what could possibly have this? And especially, it didn't look like a meteor had fallen. It didn't have the same telltale signs of that type of thing. So what it does look like, however, is maybe a gas explosion or some type of eruption where the permafrost of Siberia, a lot of it, you know, you have this trapped methane.
Sure.
In the permafrost.
Permafrost, because the soil that's frozen at the surface.
Yes, and
level.
Persistently frozen. Right. Never thaws in the spring.
Hence the perma aspect of the
hence
frost.
Hence the perma of the frost, yes. That it is, in fact, melting, and a lot of that gas is now escaping. And that gas takes up volume. We don't think of gas as being something that, you know,
sure,
brings it up. But at the same time, you shake a Coke can, especially after you warm it up a bit, you feel like the pressure goes in there. So take that Coke can, open up the lid, and suddenly the can compresses quite well.
So you're
that's
saying
what happened to the ground.
So the permafrost starts melting for some unknown reason. And
not global warming.
And there's a large amount of gas underground, maybe a long ways underground, and that basically pushes up. And as it does that, it clears a passage, so you've got like a tunnel that goes straight down.
The ground falls into the hole that opens up. Yes.
Wow.
Very similar to what you might expect from a sinkhole with water. Like the water table gets dropped and then...
Photos of this?
Yes, there are. In fact, there's a video...
And soon,
a helicopter flying into it.
Sweet.
And we will put that up on the website after the show.
Did they get to the bottom of it?
I see what you did there.
Do we need to send in the rock?
So Dan Shaw is co-founder and CEO of the enterprise Node.js company NodeSource, and Dan has a dedicated to helping and improving and expanding the Node community. He's a veteran of numerous Node startups, including Voxer and Spreecast. I don't remember that one. Sorry about that. And Storify, which I do remember. And Dan has extensive experience building large-scale, real-time, there's a lot of buzzwords here, systems with Node.js, and has been building production services using Node since version 0.2, which is actually quite a while. And Dan is a frequent speaker.
Quite brave.
Yes, back then it was a totally different ballgame.
Then you had to go, everything's fine, it'll work fine. And has been Node.js and JavaScript and runtime, a real-time conference speaker and host and all that. And of course, he's a host of Node Up Podcast. If you want to know more about Node, if you are a programmer in Node, you probably already know about the Node Up Podcast, but do listen in, it's fantastic. And you just spun off a sister podcast for Down Under, right?
Right, Node Down.
Right, I do have to ask a question right off the bat, though. So early versions of Node, did you have cron jobs that would automatically restart your Node instances on a regular basis?
No, just no hop, and they never went down.
Yeah, and
actually,
of course
literally true.
So what's no hop?
Invoke that? No hop?
Yeah.
It's just a system command that says, take this, execute the command, and then set it in the background. So... if the application ever crashed, it's just gone.
Yeah.
It's no longer bound to the port. You're not going to get any data.
You know, when you do that, and then it's large scale, a lot of customers, you find out there's bugs or not quickly.
Right.
You know,
that's true.
Over time. People seem to be unhappy.
This Netflix thing isn't working.
Right.
You also find out where the supporting libraries have problems.
Yes, you find out all the supporting libraries. So, and Dan, also you do NodeBot stuff, right? So you get people together and play with robotics and Node at the same time.
Yeah, so actually next weekend we're going to have the second annual NodeBot Day. And NodeBots Day came out of inspiration from one of the greatest conferences in JavaScript, JSConf. A couple years ago, Chris Williams, at the end of the conference, was, how can we capture the spirit of sharing that happens here at JSConf? And I've been seeing that, the robots, especially for geeks that are spending their time programming, dealing with hardware kind of takes them out of their context. I describe NodeBots as the closest thing that they can get to gathering a bunch of friends together and playing with Legos.
Yeah. Yes. So, one question: who spends all their time programming who aren't geeks?
Some people have social
point there
skills.
Is that we especially in the Bay Area where there's lots of events.
Yeah.
We spend time talking about frameworks and there's lots of energy spent around the technology side of it. Mm-hmm. But there's
in the expert zone, like in the space where they're an expert.
And it's one to many communication. But you incorporate something like hardware and playing with very simple robotics and you know, everyone gets a hands-on experience. You get to collaborate together and share what you've created at the end of the experience, and it's lots of fun. And it's a great family activity. So, you know, kids, I would love to share programming as a passion with my children, but it's just not engaging.
But you want them to love you.
Yes, I want them to care and, like, you know, not swear off programming or computers.
So this is kind of your answer, is to get some really technical space that's right. Actually also a play space as well. Right. So, and that's actually normally you do those up in San Francisco area, and those are open, right? People can come and yep. participate in those.
Yep.
So take a look at Node Bots.
If you're listening and
California,
you come
coast,
by.
Right? Yeah.
We're gonna Adobe is very generously hosting a fantastic space at Adobe.
In the San Francisco office or
in
the San Jose?
San Francisco office. Okay. San Francisco office will be there. Cool. If you head to nodebotsday.com. You can check out what's going on
cool.
there.
Cool. We'll add all these links to...
And we are gathered together across the world. There's, Russia, France, London, Guatemala, Australia.
All using the NodeBots Day plan.
Going and organizing local events. It's really... You can set up an event around this with, $100 and a hacker kit.
Yeah.
And, everyone can experiment with it.
It's cool.
So I describe
it... Set up an event like this for Node? Really?
What?
See, he got it.
I don't get it.
JavaScript.
Sorry, inside
Node.
Set up an event. Yeah, okay. All right, so we've lost our audience completely at this point. we'll get better.
Actually, I wanted to touch on something very quickly that you reminded me of, which is, and this comes in when I talked to my wife about this and other folks. How do people who spend all their time programming, like I can't imagine that I would spend all day programming, and then people do this afterwards for fun? I don't get how that would happen.
Because it's fun. Like once you've tapped into that creative element of it, the component of it that the passion comes from.
Right.
You have the opportunity to get paid for that, and that's awesome, and it's a job. And even better if you can work in a job that you're actually doing something fun and engaging that's you feel merits your time, and you frequently come away from that even inspired or The opposite case is you hate your job and you want to do
what you want to do.
Creativity in your free time.
I think of it in terms of someone who, if you don't know how to program, think of it as like you're illiterate. No, honestly.
Okay.
And so try to explain to someone why you would want to write for a living to someone who is illiterate. And then after you write for a living, like you work at a newspaper, that in your spare time, you would want to write novels. And the enjoyment and the rewards you get from that, you can't explain it to someone who hasn't spent any time getting that basic introduction to the topic.
I love that you relate this idea to the profession of writing novels, which isn't actually sane because it's your entire life.
But that's what we're doing here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And music is exactly the same way. Mm, people who don't know how to read music or know how to play a lick on the piano, explaining to people why a concert musician would also want to dabble with it and do all sorts of fun stuff online
and music is a fantastic parallel because it is as well a creative act. Mm-hmm. And many professional musicians will go, I'm thinking at the very lowest level, we were at a hotel with a band last night at a wedding reception, and the band was really into it. They're playing wedding songs. Mm-hmm. Except really did an amazing Cry Me a River, Justin Timberlake, but it was like totally inappropriate. It's like, why are you singing this for a wedding? A musician like that will play
do it all
their
the time.
Gigs, but then they most certainly will have time outside of that work. That doesn't represent their creative spark that drives them to be musicians,
just a diversion or just something that hey, right. here's something different. Let me try to stretch my skill base or my experience level. Right.
You're listening to Geek Speak. We have Miles Elam and Daniel Shaw. We're talking about programming as a joyful thing. It is hard to explain to people that don't understand. I like the metaphoric of musicians and writers. I think that's a great way to kind of sum it up rather than try to explain what programming is, because once you try to explain what programming is, you lose everybody's interest. That's not a programmer.
Right. When you try to explain what programming is, it's very much like telling people about how you have to spend a whole bunch of time in piano lessons for, right. mm-hmm. for yep. 10
Bang
years.
Your head against a brick wall.
Yeah, right. And that's not this, where the joy comes from.
And this is exactly why we don't try to force programming on our kids, right? Because exactly. we know that story. But the truth is, most people that were forced to do music as a kid appreciate they were forced to do music, right? I mean, maybe some people lose the passion. All right, well, let's talk a bit about your company, Node Source, because I'm kind of curious. The Node movement that is, I don't know, 5 years old, maybe?
5 years old, yeah.
And it's the most recent of this kind of new technology, kind of taking over an old technology in, right. in programming, and Node's kind of top of its game right now.
Right.
And it started out by some investment in JavaScript.
I don't know about taking over. It's another player. It's another instrument.
It is
it's
another
growing,
instrument.
But, I think it's growing
if you look at a sort of broader industry trend, Node is really finding this fantastic sweet spot. We have our front-end applications that are essentially written in JavaScript.
Mm-hmm.
And you know this includes the applications on
mostly
your iPad.
Rest. Yeah, sure.
Right? Your iPad, mm-hmm. You know, I'm allowed to throw
sure.
in Netflix.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Netflix's app is
most websites.
Is a web page inside
right,
of your
right.
iPad. It's you know I mean, feels like a thing, but it's just web.
Even
well, it's
like Yahoo, Google, Bing search results. All of those that look like you know those static results have yeah. non-trivial amounts of JavaScript.
And
sure.
So they're very rich JavaScript front end, and then there are these legacy. These companies have been around for you know 10, 20 years, and they have. You know, really old, crufty back-end systems.
Which are brittle, hard to change.
Which are hard to change and slow to change.
Mm-hmm.
So the teams that are dedicated to crafting these engaging user experience are you know, slowly injecting JavaScript back into the server layer with Node.js, and they're able to you know iterate and keep in a, you know a similar developer flow than what
right.
they were.
It's easy to find people to do the back end if they're already doing the front end. Like of people who are available.
The utility of finding individuals is great, but it is really the velocity which the individuals that are working on that can execute. Because you know if you're executing at you know a action a week, but that action doesn't get incorporated in what's being put into production until you know a month, 3 months, 6 months, I've heard as bad as 2 years. At the 1 year point, you know, managers are reevaluating everything. They're like, this is fundamental. Like we have a project that you know we've been trying to get out to our users for a year. And it's not like waiting for the Olympics.
Okay, so Dan, in that line of thinking, though, JavaScript's not the only language you could be doing that kind of middleware thing, right? Python is another example of that kind of scripting environment space where you can iterate quickly.
This is true, but the teams that are developing that rich front-end experience are developing it in JavaScript.
Already.
And so, you know, if they need glue, they can, you know, shift over and have what we call kind of a front end back end.
Right.
Nicholas Zakas, SlickNet, coined the term front end back end. So you know it's you know just a thin layer on top of your legacy
see.
API
it's
services.
It's the front end to the back end. It's not really the front end,
right? It's kind of a double entendre in both ways. It's the you know front end to the back end, but it's the back end to the front end too.
Right.
So
I get what you're saying. Like whenever I go to various companies and I talk to people like they work on front end versus back end, you have to figure out which back end they're talking about.
Right.
Are they talking about
the real
database
stuff,
layer?
Right.
Are they talking about the business logic that goes on to the mm-hmm. back end? Are they talking about the inner business communication level? Or are they talking about just the portion that feeds the JavaScript, feeds the HTML to yep. the front end?
Right.
And in reality, especially in these larger systems, there's a massive plurality of these back end systems because, you know, that front end back end layer will be talking to another layer, and you know that may have you know tens, hundreds, thousands of systems that it mm-hmm. talks to across a network. So yes, Very much. JavaScript is only a component of that, but it's adding a lot of value. It's adding a lot of velocity, and it's empowering a lot of server-side creativity that
it's removing the barriers to entry. It's getting the things out of your way, per se. Bring up a Node instance, use NPM to install your modules. Mm-hmm. Node Package Manager.
So. No, it doesn't stand for that, but...
It doesn't?
No.
What is NPM stand for?
It's one of those non-cronyms or something like that.
Oh,
it's like,
whatever. You know,
it's super geeky.
What do you use
geeky.
It for?
No
to install
problem,
modules as right, packages right. for Node. It's a Node package.
Yeah, and it comes with Node, and Node comes with it. Yeah, that's true. It's kind of nice. All right, we're talking Node, actually, on GeekSpeak here on KOSP. We'll be right back to talk more about this. You're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the Aramuth, we have Miles Elam. He's a software engineer. And we have Daniel Shaw. He's a software engineer as well. And so am I. And that's why we're talking about software engineering.
So, taking the geek level
So we
up.
Kind of talked about what that space is that Node has been expanding into. Right. There's also an amazingly rich community of people developing work in Node. And Node is kind of taken on early on module separation of code concerns, right? And because it's been a very clear way to include modules and GitHub so easily used, you have this explosive growth of JavaScript modules that can answer any kind of problem you have. And Miles mentioned NPM, which is a package manager that's with Node, that allows you to find libraries quickly. So it's very...
Which has just recently taken over as like the largest module community out there.
Taking over CPAN?
CPAN, yeah.
Yeah. CPAN's the Perl one.
Right.
Sorry.
No.
We all know the answers to these questions.
So
you were formerly doing a collaborative group called Node Firm, which would come in basically experts in Node, go to a business and say, hey, we'll come in here, we'll teach your staff, we'll suggest how Node could fit into your community. And one of the side, I know it's a lot of Java, big wig Java people, and they're like, Node. And it's kind of the dismissive thing. Mm-hmm. And so one of the challenges, of course, is you coming in and kind of changing a little bit of the milieu at the company so that it's successful. Right. But why are companies realizing that it's a good thing to do if their high tech staff is not saying to do it? Like that disconnect's always interesting to me.
So, you know, the developers that are, you know, saying no are your hardcore, you know, dyed-in-the-wood Java developers. And there are a few of those. But by and large, what we're finding is, especially in your larger corporations, the opportunity to be writing applications in Node is really compelling.
Because it's so fast?
Because it's so fast, because it's so modern. Mm-hmm. It's really about putting individuals on a career trajectory that is going to really allow them to grow as individuals.
What you're saying basically is the software engineers, which are really hard to get right now, really want to be doing Node.
Really want
to, so you better put Node in your infrastructure.
You know, go out of their way to individuals taking a $50,000 pay cut to work on Node is not uncommon.
Wow. So it's really a compelling environment.
It's a very compelling environment.
And to really understand that, of course, you kind of have to be a programmer and know language differences of languages. Right.
So, to go back to our music analogy, if you had the opportunity to go and, front man with some band that's amazing, or you're going to play the wedding thing. And
you're going to make more money on the wedding, yeah.
Yeah, you're probably going to make more money at the wedding, but you have the opportunity to grow and, realize your musical career by doing the frontman role.
So the Node Firm, you were doing this kind of collaboratively, a larger group, and then you said, okay, I'm going to focus down and start a business, Node Source, which a part of your mission is to create a community for Node.
So over the past year, the enterprise needs of Node have really begun to come into a story of its own. So Node is about 5 years into its existence. Early on, we're kind of a ragtag band of hackers, interesting conglomeration of systems developers and front-end developers. Over the last year, enterprise has come in and seen the value of Node. And for the enterprise, you really need a different kind of company. You need need a company that is going to be around and available and built to
service the enterprise needs.
Service the enterprise. So these companies are looking at 5 to 10 year plans, strategic plans around Node, and NodeSource is really our answer to that need.
Yeah, and you have a history in large governmental contract stuff, business contracts. So you know that place a bit, and so you think, there's a spot I'm going to operate in.
An exciting horizon, in fact, there beyond what we're thinking about in terms of enterprise. We're talking about primarily big tech companies, but there's also an even more challenging and useful need in government, where individuals have the same technology challenges that you need sort of levels of compliance and levels of bureaucratic hoops getting jumped through, and those needs are important to us, and we've been working with a governmental agency to begin to enable that and have individuals inside government being able to use the technology that they want to use
So I'm assuming relatively quickly you're going to be vamping up, because as customers come online, you're going to have to spread yourself thinner and thinner. Aren't you going to be doing a lot of bureaucracy stuff rather than a lot of programming? I mean, how are you going to satisfy that love of writing, if you will?
Well, a lot of what we do is, as a company, is research and working on Node Core. So we employ at present two core developers. Mm-hmm. Trevor Norris is a longtime core committer, and performance fanatic. And Bradley Meck is working on the revamping of the debugger for 12.14.1, whatever it's going to be.
Yeah, and I assume also that when you're doing special governmental contracts, you'll push in this idea of let's make this module that does this certain thing that needs to be done. Let's make that open source, because you don't need to have it private. In fact, if it's open source, potentially growth could happen better.
Especially as you get into the farther out edge of government.
Yeah.
If you start at enterprise is really starting to recognize the value of open source, but in my opinion, doesn't value it enough. It's useful, but often considered a cost saving center, which in my mind is totally messed up. If your all activities take time and effort, and if companies want to continue to see the software that is useful, that is driving the value of their companies, then they should be investing in that to make sure that is the case. I see that as kind of a vote with your wallet, buy a Prius or buy an electric vehicle. You believe in some fundamental thing being the right direction forward, so you
invest in
that. And so I really would like to see companies finding creative ways to invest in open source and continue to do the right value exchange, because I think some of the if you're just drawing out value from a ecosystem, then you're going to eventually starve it.
Right. Those things are called parasites, unfortunately. Yeah. All right. Cool. So you're definitely supporting open source in the entire way that you're
supporting
doing.
Open source. It's challenging for these companies to get into the idea of releasing IP. But it's definitely growing as they see that the developers that are coming to the organizations that are able to express themselves in open source get a lot of value out of that. They get a lot of career boost from being in an organization that values the developers enough to sort of put them on a pedestal, or at least
give them
share
some leeway
with the world.
And as they hire them, the culture starts to change as well. Mm-hmm. Where you're bringing in people that understand that concept of give and take, that concept of yes, we're taking this value out of it, which the companies have been great at for 15, 20 years with regard to the tech industry or with regard to the internet. But they're also now getting into this notion of, but if I try to hoard it for myself, it goes slower.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. It becomes my responsibility 100% if I do it myself.
Right. Yeah. But if I if I just wait for someone else to solve the problem, it never gets solved. Right. So when they say, like, I have a problem here, I solved this problem, let me move it out, brings up a comment that a friend of mine brought up a little while ago, which is the best way to find a better solution to your problem is propose your substandard solution.
Nice.
And people come out of the woodwork and make a better solution. Like, if you just say, how do I do this? No one answers. If you say, hey, I'm doing it this way.
No.
This should be this and this and this and this.
That's brilliant.
And so the company that comes up with this idea that scratches their itch, right, and then says, hey, here's this thing. They go like, oh, no, this could be done so much better. So even though it may help their competitors, mm-hmm, it helps them too. In a magnifier.
Yep.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, we had one more story we wanted to get to today before we head out. So let's talk a bit about Ladar Levinson's new venture. Now, Levinson had LavaBit, an email system that was designed to be secure and safe, and it famously became aware in the public eye because that's what Snowden was using as his email provider. Levinson actually made a big announcement that he had to close this company, and over time he found that the reason why is he had a court order that said give our certificates out to the government so the government can read all this email. What he was trying to provide was an email system that was completely private, and so he decided to terminate his business. Well, he's now worked up with Stephen Watt, I think a convicted hacker, actually. I mean, convicted in that he got in prison for a while. And their plan is to make a new standards around secure and private email. And this means that a very much a new protocol for doing email. The way email is done right now is you know the server that you're going to go to, the domain name, if you will, and the user name, which begin before the at symbol on the email address. And those two things have to be kind of public the entire time the transmission occurs. You could encrypt and hide the rest of it, but the to and the from and the subject kind of are part of the protocol, such that if you're doing email, you pretty much are sharing that information with the world. And that, of course, is metadata, right? So the aim of this would be to define a new protocol that would allow you to do completely private information. The only thing that would be public would be the two servers that are communicating. So if I, from GeekSpeak, wanted to send an email over to Daniel at his domain name, Disha, I would basically say, random gooblygup person at Disha.com. In this situation, it wouldn't be very anonymous because, of course, that's who you are. But the servers would communicate in that way. And it kind of takes its idea off of the Onion router. That's how you actually get unique identifiers that are disposable. So that's the aim. And I'm just kind of curious, Miles, you know a bit about email. What do you think about this idea of like redefining the standard?
I don't know enough about that particular thing. I did want to address that we already do have a point-to-point security with regard to SMTP. It's
secure sockets over SMTP, sure.
Well, TLS and a secure socket layer, both of them, but that allow you to go from one machine to another. Or if your home machine, your local mail server, let's say you're with...
I'm with Gmail. I'm Google.
Sure. Then you're sending that email and it's going through Google, and then Google needs to route that email out. When they make that connection out to Yahoo servers, for example, that oftentimes will be an encrypted connection.
Assuming that Yahoo is supporting that protocol.
Right. It mm-hmm. does have to do with whether or not the destination supports encryption. Most folks going out will support encryption, but it's whether the destination will also allow that is usually the limiting factor.
But you could have that email delivered and stripped off of any sort of privacy as it, you know, goes down the chain. And
right. But at the same time, when you're talking about the from to, that isn't protecting people from listening in from the outside. That is protection against an ISP like Google or Verizon.
Right.
And so that is interesting. So, I don't know enough about it, though.
So the general concept would be, let's say, I'm at Yahoo. Yeah, let's say I'm at Yahoo and I'm going to send an email to Miles and he's using Google, Gmail. So I send my message and it says to Miles at you know, Google, whatever. And when I do that communication, I communicate through that privately. So now Yahoo has my private communication. No one else knows. But Yahoo does know that I'm communicating with you. Mm-hmm. And then Yahoo sends a message to you and then to Google. And then Google knows that Yahoo sent it and that it came from me and it's going to you. So the ISPs themselves, the mail providers, actually know a lot about it. This protocol, the idea behind it would be it'd be even less aware.
You would know that a message went from Yahoo to Google.
And you know that it would be targeted for you, Miles, but you wouldn't know, but Google wouldn't know where it came from, and Yahoo wouldn't know where I was sending it to. So it would be slightly
Well, the idea is that you know there was communication between the two, but you wouldn't know who.
But even the ISPs wouldn't know the from or the sender if it wasn't their side, right? So that's where even more of it gets, or the mail provider.
Of course, it does require buy-in from the ISPs. So.
It requires buy-in from everybody, and that's the thing is you can't redefine a protocol. Like, that's the problem with it, right? We know it's kind of broken in that we have to trust our internet service providers a lot. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if you can really change it. Though I think celebs could probably do it. That would help.
Yeah, I actually love that this exploration is being done in kind of a very esoteric hacker community.
Yeah.
Because these are the individuals who have the patience to...
And the paranoia.
And the paranoia, right. Legitimately, I'll get the paranoia. To explore this, there have been several attempts to redefine the email protocol. I don't know if you remember, like, AOL and Microsoft a few years ago, you know, tried to redefine. And I think, you know, one of the goals may have been defeating spam. And, you know, there was some
also to make a walled garden, but yeah.
Right, there were some pay-to-play components in there. And all of those initiatives really... really, you know, should have failed.
Right.
The openness of email is what made it succeed, or of our modern email.
The openness of email, the openness of HTTP, absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so that's why I think it's exciting is that you could see increase the security aware society could be producing a better, more secure, private business. So that's why
I wish them well.
Definitely.
I hope we'll get the benefits.
And Dan, I wish you well in your new venture, Node Source for enterprise and government stuff in Node. And I'm sure I'll see you around at conferences Node Bots Day
next week.
Definitely.
Note up.
Awesome. Thank you, Daniel Shaw, for joining me on Geekspeak. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence and used with permission. Miles Elam was also on the show. You're listening to KUSP at 88.9 and KUSP.org. You can learn more about us at geekspeak.org.